Hi, Wendy Thompson. Welcome to KBOO.
Hey, Bill. Appreciate it.
Wendy Thompson retired in 2005 after 33 years on the shop floor assembling axles for trucks and SUVs in the plant that was called then Chevy Gear and Axle. It became, after GM sold it, it became American Axle. Wendy stayed on. She was then the union president. She was the first woman hired in the plant for the shop floor. And at the time, around 8,000 men. It became much less. She was a union militant. About halfway into her 33 years, she was elected to the shop floor chair, which is an important position in the plant, and in 1999, elected to president of her local. Of course, it was the United Auto Workers Union. We'll be discussing today's UAW and the push by UAWD, that is United Auto Workers for Democracy. It's a caucus that's struggling for democracy and much more in their plant, including environmental response to global warming. First, well, Wendy Thompson, tell us your story. How and why did you get a job assembling axles? What were your aims? And then we'll talk about why you stayed on.
Well, it really was the fact that I belonged to a political family growing up. My parents were active in the civil rights movement, and I became active myself at the age of 12. So I was very concerned about the question of racism. And then later on, I decided I was going to be a teacher. And I went to France because I was going to teach French, and I was junior year abroad, and I was there in 1968. And it was there, actually, where I came in contact for the first time with the labor movement. The unity between students and workers there was just amazing to me. I came back to the United States deciding that I wanted to be active to change things. I really had left because love it or leave it, I hated it. I was going to leave. But my friend said, no, go back to your country. That's where you'll have an impact. And so I took that seriously and decided that I would have more of an impact if I became an auto worker than if I became a teacher, which is ironic because teachers are playing a big role in the labor movement today. So I was living in Los Angeles, but I was in touch with other political people. They were all going to Detroit. Detroit was the epicenter because it was not the question of black leadership in the community that had the power, but black leadership in the working class. So you had a drum develop here in Detroit. They had a film they put out. I was just very excited by that.
Tell us what drum was, just for a second.
Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement is what it was called. And it was organized in the auto plants. And they put on a film about their organizing, what they were trying to do, and seemed very effective. You know, they could not kill off the black leadership if they were working in the plant like they could in the community, because then they might deal with strikes. That was the idea. So I picked up and went to Detroit specifically to become an auto worker. I grew up around Chicago, so I was moving back from Los Angeles to the Midwest where I grew up. And I really appreciated living in the black community and working in a factory with a majority black workforce. Yes, I was one of the first women, and that was exciting also to be making that change. But I know that's not your normal history, but I have no regrets of having made that decision way back when, under very different circumstances than what we have today, unfortunately. Yeah. No movement like we had then.
Right. You wrote a short biography, it was published by a couple of journals of the left. You wrote that in the 1970s, capital was restabilizing, I guess making profits then, putting down worker rebellion, responding to the Japanese and German invasion, making profits. Quite a few radicals then left industrial work, but you and many others decided to stay. And I'm quoting you, you decided to be revolutionaries in a decidedly non-revolutionary period and prepare for a future upsurge. Looking back, what do you see as your frustrations and failures, but also your accomplishments? Seems to me it's a bit of half empty, a lot full. How do you see it?
Well, you know, when I got to the plant, I started to see myself as an organizer. And the consciousness of workers at that time was very much they felt that they could bring about change. They felt like they had a lot of power. So it was a positive environment that I was in terms of people who I felt wanted to struggle and fight back like I did. But then when the crisis came, the oil crisis, things did change. But you know what still remained was the class struggle. And that was what kept me active and busy. And I didn't feel like nothing was going on. There always seemed to be some fight that was going on every day when I went to work. And I never really thought about giving up on that, except for once, you know, having wanted to be a French teacher, I was thinking of moving to Quebec when the struggle was there. The union movement was so strong in the 1970s. But I remembered that it is, again, like my friends in France had said, it's in your own country that people are going to listen to you the most. And I found even though I was white in a majority black setting, that I did get listened to, and it was appreciated the fact that I wasn't racist like most white people in the plant were at that time. So I never really wanted to quit, and I always was happy that I stayed on. Another thing, too, though, is I got fired 3 times and got back to work each time with back pay. That does not happen very often. And as my fellow activists would say to me, boy, you are such a positive example. Don't give that up. I mean, you know, if I got back to work with all that and then quit, it would all be lost. So that was a motivation for me to stay. GM didn't want me, and I was going to hang in there and make sure that I stayed and gave them a whole lot of trouble, which I did.
This is Bill Resnick for KBOO Radio and the Old Mo Variety Hour, talking to Wendy Thompson, who worked 33 years making axles in Detroit. In her last 16 years, she served as a shop chair. That's an important position. We'll be hearing a little bit more about what she did in it. And then the union president. So, Wendy, these were not office jobs. You didn't sit around. I imagine you were near always on the shop floor. What are your tasks in those jobs? What did you do in those elected positions? I imagine was lots of arguments with foremen and their supervisors and the plant managers and maybe even some of the upper management. Tell us about that, what you were doing on a daily basis.
Yes, well, true. I did have a reputation of taking on the really disgusting supervisors in the plant. There were many of them, and they treated workers just terribly, and I would go to war with them, and I sort of had notches on my belt because I would drive them crazy. And one of the things was, of course, always being on the shop floor. Most union reps would hide out somewhere, and you would never see them. But I was always there, and I encouraged people to write grievances, and not in just individual grievances, but group grievances. Every time it rained, it would come pouring through the roof, and I would go around and get everybody's signature on a health and safety grievance. So everything went into the grievance procedure. I distributed a newsletter on a monthly basis. The entire 33 years that I was there, it didn't matter if I held a position or I didn't hold a position, I felt like talking about what was going on in the plant and what the key issues were was fundamental. And that newsletter was very important and pretty awful later on when I was a president and the shop chair was my enemy and he told management not to let me in the plant, that I stood by the plant gates and handed out the leaflets, and workers would say, oh, I see you more than I see my union rep. That's pretty awful that that would be the situation. So I tried to change a lot of things. We had a group working together in the early days. Later on, it was harder to get people to be active in a group, but I still would try to hold meetings at lunchtime and break time or right before work or right after work, and always would be listening to what the concerns of the people were on the shop floor and then trying to get them to organize around their concerns and fight back.
There must have been many wildcat strikes. It's often some part of the assembly line break down and the workers decided it was a real safety problem or whatever and demanded that it be fixed before they returned to the line. that happened very much was that you must have been right in the middle of every one of those little struggles.
Yes, 1973, we had 3 wildcat strikes, and I was involved in those. But it would be a thing, a thing of workers would come up to me and say, "We're walking out at 10 o'clock. And I would go, "Okay." But I learned that if you hear that that's when people are going to be walking out, you do leave the line. I was working on the line at the time. But after you leave the line and go out to the aisle, turn around and look back and see whether everybody else has left the line or not. If everybody is still on the line and you walked, go get a drink of water and go back to work. Luckily, in my situation, everybody did leave. But we did have some people who were slow, and we had to push them to go out the door. But we were lucky. Nobody got fired. This was in 73 when this was happening a lot. But later on, you know, there were not any wildcat strikes later on after the oil crisis, and people became more hesitant. Wildcat strikes in my plant anyway did stop. But it was exciting when it was happening.
You represented your members. I gather all of those meetings that you had were also people discussed what was going on in the plant, what they could do, and a whole lot of people in your tenure were educated as to, in fact, the, quote, class struggle, and understanding that workers only made gains when they really struggled. And you were also a member of a number of rank-and-file groups, the New Directions Movement early in the 1990s. You participated in the auto caravan. We'll talk about that. You're now participating with UAWD, Unite All Workers for Democracy. You were always in struggle then, not just with the company men, down from the lowliest foreman to the plant manager and probably above, trying to get rid of you, and it was impossible. But also you were in struggle with the UAW bureaucracy that was very committed to keeping control. So give us a sense of that struggle and the capacity of the old guard to keep reproducing itself. New leaders, new men, but cut from the same cloth.
I mean, our idea of us who went into the auto plants was that the UAW was a progressive union because of the ideas Walter Reuther had developed in terms of unity between the community, getting involved in the civil rights struggle. But what we really underestimated was that he had built this caucus that was very highly centralized under his control. And he controlled it from the top of the union down to the bottom of the union. And that remained incredibly strong. And fighting against it was very, and to this day, still is, very difficult. But they, you know, with their control over everything, they jumped right into going along with management through what was called joint activity programs and saying that our interests are the same, the company and the union. And then they went along with just-in-time and lean production management systems, which are pervasive today, but were developing beginning in the 1980s. So this is where New Directions came in to fight back against this system of lean production and joint activity. And it was where they were able to elect one independent to the International Executive Board, and that made this enormous caucus hysterical because they want total control. They didn't want any independence. So I very much got involved in trying to build this movement, but they came down on us like a ton of bricks. And I was shop chair of the shop committee, which is the top position in the GM structure at that time. And the fact that I supported an independent and not the administration caucus in the elections, they came into my plan, I'm talking about International Union, and organized a local caucus against New Directions where they promised everybody an appointment. This is how they were able to keep their control. You didn't have to get elected anymore. You could have a permanent job that pays a lot more for the rest of your life. And this is still going on in the union today, and it is one of the things that has led to the corruption charges that have been so devastating on the UAW and are ongoing at this point in time.
You know, let me be a devil's advocate. the UAW bureaucracy, I think that, of course, they like their jobs and big salaries and trips to Bell Harbor with the AFL-CIO and playing golf down there in Florida and the rest of the stuff that goes on. But what they had was this sort of ideology that, yes, they, first they thought that they should get big salaries because they were fighting with people who were making millions a year. And second, though, they thought that they were saving the jobs of their constituents, working people on the line. They had a tough job in some way that they didn't do very well. But the Japanese and Germans were building good cars, and GM and Ford and Chrysler had to catch up. They lost a huge amount of market share. And in fact, they considered the militants in the union like you to be creating an atmosphere of resistance to the kinds of changes that they thought necessary if they're going to build a decent car and compete in the market and save American jobs. Well, of course, that wasn't true. The auto plants were moving out of the country, and that's another problem they had. They wanted to save jobs, so they made deals to keep the plants in the country and create, for example, a two-tiered system where new people were hired for whatever it was, somewhat above the minimum wage, but nothing like the people who had worked for a long period. How do you respond to that argument? I don't think it's accurate, but I'm being devil's advocate.
On the question of quality, you know, it's exactly the opposite. That is, on the shop floor, you can see that management did not care about quality whatsoever. Run it, you know. That was what they said. And so we, as the militants, tried to take up that issue and say quality should be a strikeable issue. So we felt like we were the ones talking about how to make better quality. And they were the ones, the company management, that was causing a situation where the quality was not good. But, you know, the other thing, too, as far as fighting back, is that the union went along with this idea of one plant getting played off against another so that the ones that would get the work would be the ones that would be willing to give the most concessions. But there's no end to that. It's just a funnel downwards. And instead of having it be where issues could not be negotiated on the local level because they wanted everybody to have the same standard nationally, they allowed more and more to be negotiated separately and allowed this situation where things just got worse and worse. As far as plant closings, they had no strategy to fight back against that, because actually the strategy is a pretty big one. That is, anytime they threaten to close one plant, you have to threaten to strike all plants to keep that plant open. That's the idea. Don't give any no local to give a concession, or else they're going to have to deal with the union nationally. And then internationally, that should have been the same strategy. You know, work not going from one country to another because unions in those countries have united together and they all fight back. Why not Mexican workers and American workers going out on strike at the same time with a unified list of demands? So we were the ones trying to build international unionism and going down to Mexico and participating in labor conferences, but the leadership of the union was not doing that. So they just played into the company's hands. And then what did they care? They got great salaries, but they let workers' salaries go downhill. And so the difference between their salaries and our salaries became very, and still is, very great. Not good.
This is Bill Resnick for KBOO Radio and the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Wendy Thompson. Wendy, thanks a lot for talking to us today.